Okay. Hello, everyone, and welcome. We're beginning here with some case studies. Our first case study has to do with a man in his mid-50s. And the reason we're going through these case studies is because these are things that we've either found to be particularly challenging for us, and so we can explain our thinking as we go through them, and or they've given us clinical insights and pearls that we want to share with you so you can learn from them.
So our first case that we want to present is a 50-year-old man who originally came to our office because his daughter had taken a class on nutrition and found herself very interested in food sensitivity testing, had relayed this information to her father, and it's her father that ended up in our office. And he had no health issues whatsoever, you know, going through a complete review of systems and the questionnaire, it was over and over and over again, asking more detailed question, and every answer was, I'm fine. He just really was there for food testing. So we ran food testing, also convinced him in the beginning to run the Vibrance America major blood screen, and just convinced him of that because of how Vibrance testing is so cost affordable to patients, and so he did wind up taking that as well. But you know, we weren't really looking for anything in particular. We just decided to order this man his food testing and thought it might be as simple as that.
So here's what we found. We ordered a Cyrex Array 10. And the reason why we ordered this one is because he wanted food sensitivity testing, and Array 10 does a good job at looking at a whole bunch of different foods and giving IgG and IgA reactions to those different foods. And it differentiates to some degree between raw and cooked foods and different components or constituents within different foods. So it's a really nice top-of-the-line test for doing food sensitivities. So as you see here, we found a lot of things in the red range, which essentially means that he's very reactive. So of the things on this page, about half seem to be in the red. So wild rice and then all of the beans and legumes.
So that first page starts to make us a little bit interested because, you know, there's a lot of things that are coming up that he is highly reactive to, but we're still just curious. Like, you know, this is all pretty much in the bean family. We're all in the legume family. Does he just have some sort of sensitivity to something within that food, that class of food as a whole? But as we start flipping through the many other pages of the Array 10, we start realizing that that's not actually what's happening here. So we see, you know, several of these nuts come up. Still, you know, nothing is horrible yet, but definitely significant. And now as we continue on, look at what we're seeing here. Like, going down the vegetable line, and this is starting to make us really curious. We're finding lettuce and mushrooms and green beans and corn and eggplant and you know, carrots, cabbage, these are not foods that people are, you know, typically overdoing to a point where they would start having a sensitivity to. So once we're at this page of the Array 10, we're really starting to question what is going on here. What's the root?
And then when we continue on and we look at fruit that's raw and unmodified, we see reaction to apple, cantaloupe, cherry, coconut, meat, fig, grape, grapefruit, kiwi, that's a lot also in the fruit section.
And same thing, look at this. I mean, on and on, the meat, the herbs, like this is crazy being that reactive to basil, cilantro, cumin, dill, mint. Like, you know, this is what, you know, we are just getting more and more and more data here about how leaky this man's gut is.
So if you're live on the call, on the conference here, then you can go ahead and type in something that you think that might be going on here into the chat to everyone. What's happening here? So here's already some clues. We're thinking something along the lines of leaky gut. Is autoimmune a possibility? Are there intestinal inflammation causing leaky gut? And if so, what's the cause of that? And why no symptoms? What's the deal here? So think a little bit for yourself about what might be underlying at the root cause level, because leaky gut we don't usually consider to be a root cause. We usually consider there to have been some trigger to get to the leaky gut, which could in some case be a food, like wheat or gluten in some people who are sensitive to it, or perhaps in some other people it could be a poor diet over a very long period of time. But frequently there's some other cause to get us to that point. So
remember that autoimmune is most always what we're seeing in the research going to be a combination of a few different things. Genetics, that environmental trigger as a second thing, and then third component being leaky gut. So anytime that we're seeing that there's this many food allergies, this many food sensitivities, I should say, we should pretty much always consider that autoimmune possibility and be keeping our eye out for it. Oftentimes we're seeing that many people have autoimmune markers that show up a long time before they have any actual autoimmune symptoms. So this is really exciting, right? Because if we can see the markers before the symptoms arise, like we can actually catch the disease process before it's truly manifested and made people feel bad. And this is going to be a huge, huge, huge ticket for us to look at something like this test and to make sure that we're considering and looking at the possibilities of autoimmunity.
So if we're looking essentially at a food sensitivity test like the Array 10 and we see more than, you know, a few things in the red, we're starting to see 10, 20, 30 things in the red throughout this test, we're thinking definitely leaky gut, and then we're wondering why, and we're considering, because of leaky gut, if there's a genetic predisposition, there could be an autoimmune condition and other causes of intestinal inflammation.
So then wanted to take you guys through some of the various labs that we found here. And from the rheumatoid section from Vibrant America's lab, they put the hsCRP in the rheumatoid section. Just want to clear this up that this is the hsCRP is a general systemic inflammatory marker. It has been correlated in some research to be a little more correlated with cardiac inflammation. But in general, we're finding this to go up in inflammation of all kinds. So even though we're looking at this and we're saying, oh, the rheumatoid marker is elevated, this isn't really a rheumatoid marker. All this hsCRP at 1.3 is telling us is there's inflammation in the body. And we already were thinking that. You know, we were already thinking that when we saw that lab with all those IgG markers. So this is just more evidence to us. It's not telling us and confirming that there's leaky gut, but it's just more evidence to our theory and our consideration that yes, there is an inflammatory condition happening.
So a lot of people will group hsCRP as sort of a general inflammatory marker that just doesn't tell us where. Some people think about it in relation to the cardiovascular system, although it's also not specific to that. And then of course, some people group it in with other autoimmune conditions like rheumatoid. Again, it's not specific, it's general. So we know there's inflammation happening somewhere. But we don't see other evidence of rheumatoid. So in this blood test, we see RF is rheumatoid factor, and we don't see an elevation in that. And the anti-CCP3, IgG and IgA is another marker that is more specific to rheumatoid, but we don't see an elevation in that either. So we're thinking inflammation, but not rheumatoid. So what else might we see?
So looking at some other autoimmune markers, this is a great start that we have to an autoimmune panel that Vibrance America does. And we're basically looking for different specific antibodies. And we see here that all of these antibodies are within the normal range, meaning not only is there not a rheumatoid condition, we're not seeing any signs of an autoimmune condition here. So that's really exciting to us because we're probably leaky gut is so correlated with autoimmunity, like we said, that we're likely catching this if there's a genetic factor prior to that trigger actually occurring, or we're catching it prior to the leaky gut being perhaps as severe as it could be.
So this isn't every autoimmune condition, and the list of autoimmune conditions goes up and up and up every year as we discover autoimmune components to a variety of different conditions. So this is really just scratching the surface of autoimmunity. Of course, here in other areas of this same test, there's There's things like thyroid antibodies, but those aren't here. These are, though, some of the ones that we can measure and some of the ones that, we do want to sometimes take a look at, and we do sometimes see elevated in people who are not yet exhibiting symptoms of an autoimmune condition. Because like Diane said earlier, these markers can elevate years before we see symptoms. So this is a great way for us to, have early detection, especially if we have some reason to suspect leaky gut, as we do in this case. But in this case, we don't see these particular markers elevated.
So continuing on, we're seeing under glycemic control, we see that, glucose, this is fasting, and he has a glucose of 96. And for most people, we're finding like a functional range to be somewhere between about 75 to 85. So being this at 96 in a fasting state, you know, there's certainly always things we can be asking people of, like, when was their last meal? Did, you know, did they do this test first thing at 8 in the morning but didn't have their last meal till midnight? And what was their last meal? Was it really heavy, really fattening? Is it something that would stay in their blood or in their body for a long time before it was, like, digested and either stored or turned into sugar or energy? So there's other things to consider here, but we're going to definitely, if we see this 96 of glucose, we are going to want to start asking people about those types of questions so we can elicit if this is a problem or not.
Now, glycomark and glycerated serum protein are less common markers, so you may or may not be familiar with them. But essentially, they're looking at the peaks and the lows. So essentially, we may have an average blood sugar that's normal, but, you know, it could be going really sharp up, down, up, down, up, down. If it's going really sharp up, down, up, down, we might see these spikes that are high, or we might see these dips that are really low without being able to assess that from just looking at things like glucose and hemoglobin A1C. So if you're unfamiliar with those two markers, that's what they're about. And we don't see evidence of imbalance in either of those. So no elevation in glycerated serum protein, although it's close, 289. And we're looking for less than or equal to 300. So that when we're getting close to lab range, we're starting to just raise a little bit of a question mark in our mind. So we're wondering about that. But glycomark is well above the 10.7 at 15.4, so we're not so concerned there. And hemoglobin A1C, which is a rough estimate of an average for blood sugar levels over the past 2 months or so, is really good at 5. That's a nice sweet spot. We'd love to see 5 or less as a functional range, and so this is, you know, on average looking really good, although hemoglobin A1C is impacted by some genetic factors and the size of red blood cells and things like that. So there's a little bit more to consider than just the hemoglobin A1C value itself, but it's a really good marker and a really helpful one for us to assess.
Another thing about hemoglobin A1C is how it actually works is when we have elevated blood sugar for a certain point of time, for a longer period of time, we actually have something's created called glycated end products. And these glycated end products basically will attach to other organs, other cells in our body, and our red blood cells being a huge place of this glycated end products end up. And so this hemoglobin A1C, when we're trying to get that amount of time that it is representative of, it's a little bit varied in the research. On the short end, it's more like 60 days. On the long end, it's more like 90 days. Red blood cells a lot of times will last for about 90 days, but of course there's some early turnover and these things in there. So, you know, we're really looking at 60 to 90 days in here. And one of the biggest points with that is what it tells us, let's say glucomark and glycomark and glycated serum protein, I'm sorry, with glucose and glycomark and glycated serum protein don't, is that it's a longer period of time versus a short period of time, such as, you know, just that snapshot in time we get from these other serum markers.
So hemoglobin A1C, again, that's a longer period of time. These other ones are a shorter period of time. So that really helps us to assess that, you know, there may be some little bit of spiking. It's a little more than we might expect by seeing his fasting glucose at 96 and the glycerated serum protein at 289. Other than that, we're thinking, well, blood sugar looks pretty good on the glycemic control side. When we look at insulin resistance side, we look at a couple of different markers. And so we have measured here adiponectin and fasting insulin. So I'm going to jump to fasting insulin because it's a really interesting marker. It's fasting insulin is something that in general we want to be very, very aware of, and we can have insulin resistance before we have a blood sugar issue. So this is something that it's very important for us to assess and be aware of. Now, in order to get the most accurate assessment of insulin, we would optimally want to see the curve of insulin after eating. In other words, we'd like to have them eat a meal with a controlled amount of sugar and then get an insulin mark when they're fasting, and then again after 2 hours after they had eaten. That's going to sort of give us that insulin curve that would give us the most information. But that's very difficult to do and requires a lot of controlled testing. There are some offices who are doing things like a glucose tolerance test, which measures glucose regularly, but insulin, the technology isn't such to be able to measure it as easily. So it's really hard to get that insulin curve that would give us the optimal information. But fasting insulin is about as good as we are able to reasonably get at this time. And so we have this fasting insulin marker, and that's going to be helpful for us. And again, it's got its problems because we're not seeing the curve. And the curve may or may not be paired or correlate exactly to this fasting value, but we can approximate that we'd like to see this fasting value functionally about in the 0 to 5 or the maybe 1 to 5 range in order to be sort of at a good level of not having insulin resistance being an issue. So even though he's in the technical lab range that goes up to 24.9 for the reference range here, a 15 we would generally consider to be high, and that there is potentially some insulin resistance at play here.
And it's a little bit, it's another area of debate in the field right now, is like what truly is the low end of insulin. And it's not a clear, we don't have a clear answer to that. And I can tell you that, you know, my personal feeling is that, you know, anytime we're like actually in the 0 to 1 range, I get nervous that that's our body still saying a problem. I mean, we want to see insulin here. Insulin needs to be in our body to get sugar into our cells. So my personal preference is that is for between the 2 and the 5 range. But like I said, you know, Miles is comfortable more down in the 1 range. It really, it's a little bit, it's just a little bit unclear where that bottom end is. But I would certainly say, you know, if we're getting down into the 0 range, we might start asking ourselves if this is normal and, you know, take a look at the research, because we're hoping that there'll be something that comes out over the next couple of years that will be help us determine a little bit more what that lower end of the range actually is.
So for now, we're, you know, usually not seeing a whole lot of people who are under 2. So it's not a big, you know, population that we're dealing with. But once we start to get under 2, starting to question it. Once we get under 1, definitely questioning it. Once we get above 5, also questioning it. So in this case, we see 15, definitely questioning that as potentially contributing to insulin resistance. So that's a piece of the puzzle here. And, you know, it's not one that we're going to go into an incredible amount of detail in because of sort of the intricacies of blood sugar issues and cardiometabolic issues are a whole nother topic for a whole nother module at some point. But we do want to absolutely be aware of blood sugar irregularities and do our best to help to combat insulin resistance as soon as we are able, in order to help with a variety of preventing other issues from happening later on.
And then, so, you know, our next question, of course, with, like we were saying, with seeing all those IgG reactions, is what's going on in the gut? What is going on? Like, is there a leaky gut? Most likely, we can be pretty guaranteed with seeing those sort of numbers. And like Miles said earlier, if there's leaky gut, what is the cause of it? So we ran a couple different stool cultures. We ran doctor's data and DRG. And these were the most pertinent findings we found on the doctor's data. We found one of the samples had some endolymics nana, and that was pretty much it, if I remember right, from this doctor's data.
And we did see a low secretory IgA also. So that's another finding that's interesting to us. And so we're beginning to ask ourselves, why is that low? Is there too much stress? And is that lowering SIGA, because we see that in research? So that's a question.
And remember, the low stress or the high stress will cause a low secretory IgA. Remember, another thing that can do is chronic infection. So it's like if we've had infections for a chronic period of time, we can see IgA levels go down. So these are definitely questions we want to be asking our clients. And, you know, when talking to this about this particular, with this particular client, he is in a very, very, very high stress, upper level corporate job. But he definitely presents as very, very calm. And when asked about stress, when asked about mental health, emotional triggers, you know, going through some of the gastrointestinal questions that we talked about of like, you know, can you stomach life? Can you, you know, change directions and can be flexible with challenges? And everything that has been asked to him in that mental emotional standpoint, he's always, his reaction is always just like in the beginning of the questionnaire with symptoms of saying like, I'm fine. Everything's just fine. Everything's good. So yeah, it's no problem. And certainly that may be true. And when we're seeing SIGA to the level that it is, you know, we also just want to keep this in the back of our mind that this 17.1, that maybe, you know, maybe he doesn't have awareness around his stress, and maybe there is stress, but there's not even a cognition of it.
A lot of times people will not necessarily feel stressed either because they've habituated to stress or because maybe they have good mental control, but their nervous system may be overactivated anyway, and they may have stress hormones elevated anyway. So something to look into even for people who seem calm and seem to report that they feel pretty good most of the time.
So then the secondary stool culture with this particular client we did was the DRG. And here we found another pathogen. So we see that we have Helicobacter pylori here. So that's definitely another component of his, likely his leaky gut.
And of course we know with H. pylori that it lowers stomach acid, and when stomach acid goes down, there's increased susceptibility to pathogens getting in. And he has low SIGA, so potentially a diminished immune response to those pathogens once they get in. So this is something that we have to consider and definitely work with for thinking about stomach acid as well as the pathogens.
So the parasites were clear, and then we also see Aspergillus. So we see a fungus here, and Aspergillus is a very, very strange fungus to have. And after much questioning with him, we cannot actually remember where we can't figure out where he contracted the Aspergillus, but certainly something that we do want to address.
Then we looked at the Dutch dried urine test for complete hormones. The adrenal part here has a DHEA value of 108, which is a little lower than we'd like to see in men. So we can consider that to be on the low end of normal or even a little below functionally optimal. And then we see the total metabolized cortisol to be right up against that high end. And when it's right up against that high end, that's indicating to us that there may be an elevated activity of the HPA axis. So he may be on overdrive even if he doesn't feel it, even if he feels somewhat calm. There may be a sense of some overactivity of cortisol But of course, people feel more the free portion, which we get to in just a moment here. But the overall activity may be a little bit high, and there are several potential causes for that, including inflammation being one. So we could think in this case about inflammation as potentially contributing towards that output of metabolized cortisol being on the high end.
And then just to give you guys a little information context here with how this test got run, despite him not having any fatigue, this was really just something that we recommended to him because of having such a high stress job, and explaining to him, you know, this sort of thing that I was saying earlier, that just because you're not experiencing stress doesn't mean there's a physiological process that's happening in your body because of the stress, and this would be a good thing to check on. So that's pretty much how we got him to do this test at the beginning. There wasn't fatigue, but we can see, you know, with this lower DHEA that, yes, there is definitely some sort of stress that is taking a physiological toll on his body.
And then when we look down here at the free cortisol pattern, this is the portion of cortisol that's available to bind in the cell, and it's generally going to be more felt by people. So we do see that on waking, he's in the middle of that range, which, you know, this is the high range limit, this is the low range limit. He's smack dab in the middle. So he's got a good cortisol awakening response, which is great for someone who's in a high stress job, that it's not either overly elevated or depleted. So that's a really positive finding. And then when we look at the morning response, we see it's in the upper half, but still within the normal range. Afternoon starts to get a little low towards the bottom of the range. So, you know, we can tell that he might have more of an afternoon dip than, I mean, naturally, as you can see, the curve dips in the afternoon. Naturally, there's a wane of energy a little bit in the afternoon. But he might have a little bit of an extra dip in the afternoon, have to dip a little deeper in order to push through that afternoon. And so we can definitely help that situation out. And then the night, we see elevated. So, you know, we have to wonder and ask about whether there's trouble with sleeping, because that elevated cortisol at night may, in some cases, prevent someone from going to sleep or from sleeping deeply, and may be a result of a second wind and or someone who potentially stays up and works on electronics into the evening, which, you know, a lot of people who are in high power positions and stressful jobs often will do that. So,
and he has no problem sleeping at all. So I don't think this cortisol is coming, it was creating a lack of sleep. But what I'm curious about, like with this evening cortisol, is that it's actually being created from doing exactly what Miles is talking about here, about pushing his work late into the evening. And he works really, really late. He definitely has this belief that has been elicited that we have found around, you know, hard work equals something, that he is, there's something really, really of value that he can say he has because he works hard into the evening. That's just a really positive trait he's identified with inside of himself. So, you know, he's only sleeping a lot of times 5 hours of sleep or so, and we see this evening cortisol. So it could be that part of what's happening is he's working himself so much that he's actually stimulating, like we would in shift work, a later release of cortisol to meet up with those demands. And we see over time for people that do shift work, and we'll get into this in a lot more detail in the adrenal module, but we'll see over time that the actual total cortisol usually winds up being higher in people that work late at night or people that work through the night, that maybe in some people say they'd have a shifted circadian rhythm where they spike at different times of the day. Maybe their morning cortisol awakening response at first spike is actually lower for people when shift work, and then maybe it spikes later in the day. But what we see is when the circadian rhythm gets out of whack, so to speak, for too long, that the total cortisol production goes up. And from a metabolized cortisol level, we can certainly see that here.
So when we look at the, here's just the bottom of that same lab, and basically what this is showing us in addition is just this total, when we add up all of these single free cortisol values, what's the total and where is that on the range of low to high? So we do see when we add up all these single values, we do see that we're in that definitely upper half of the range, creeping towards the high end of the range. So, you know, this is still in range. This is not necessarily a problem, although, you know, if it went much higher than this, that could be. So with the total metabolized cortisol being as high as it is and the free cortisol being towards this upper end, we're definitely thinking, okay, the HPA axis is potentially stimulated into either a hypercortisolism, sort of a steady state or close to that on that edge. So that's something that we're definitely wanting to consider here.
So after analyzing this data, we find that he has adrenal dysregulation, some sort of blood sugar imbalances. We have multiple infections, the Endolimix nana, the Aspergillus, the H. pylori. So we have a lot of different things to work at, despite this man having no symptoms and just purely being curious. And remember, a lot of like all of these stool tests came about after we did that full panel of the Cyrex IgG and we saw all of those food sensitivities. So that was what led us down this road of let's see what's in the gut.
So such an interesting case, because we find that with no chief complaints, that there's quite a few things going on here, that it's easy for people to habituate things, and especially people who are able to make their way into high power positions are people who have generally a lot of mental control. So mind over body is something that really people in our culture value, especially people who work towards success in the world. And for these kinds of people, there can be this sense of being okay. And this is more true, we find, in men than women typically. Women tend to be a little more tuned into what's wrong and ask for help. Men, frequently, there's this cultural value for men to not reach outside of themselves and to man it up and to just, you know, deal with it and push forward. And so we have to look for that sort of attitude in men and women both, particularly in men and particularly in men in high power positions. So we have to look for that attitude, and that could be something at play in the mind root cause here, is that there may not be a level of awareness, of tuning into subtlety, or if there is awareness, there may be a pushing through and a trudging onward that's kept within the value system that may be preventing action from being taken sooner rather than later. But in this case, we've been able to find these things because of strange circumstances that brought this man in to begin testing, and that initial test result just spurred us to be able for him to see that there is some value in diving a little deeper and seeing what's going on. So here's some follow-up testing.
So, and let's go back, because I want to talk a little bit about a couple we focused on here. We didn't do tons of the adrenal dysregulation stuff in the beginning. We did put him on a very basic adrenal protocol just to get things started. And we'll talk more about in that module what that looks like. We did work on some herbal blood sugar support, and we did treat the Endolimix, the Aspergillus, the H. pylori. And while we were treating those, we did actually also use colostrum. So we were working on the leaky gut, working on these pathogens all at the same time. The Endolimix nana, the H. pylori, we use pretty common treatments that you guys are familiar with, a parasite blends, and we use our Goodnight Parasite. And then for H. pylori, combinations of Mastica and Pyloricil. For the Aspergillus, though, what we actually did was we did kind of like a fungal and mold and yeast protocol. So we put them on some of our Candida products that we use, like the AC formula and C Candida. We also use binders for any of the toxins like charcoal and bentonite. And then from there, we also added another product from the company Byron White called AFNG. So that was our approach, just so you guys are aware of that.
So here's a repeat stool culture. Now, what's interesting about this is that we see that there is still a positive on H. pylori, even after the treatment protocol. But what's different about this is that there are virulence factors for H. pylori that are positive now that weren't before. So if we look back to the before lab, we see H. pylori was positive, but the virulence factor, CAG A and BAC A, were both negative. Here, in the post-test, we see that the virulence factor for CAG A and BAC A are both positive. So this is indicating to us that there may be some fight happening potentially, and you know, H. pylori has these in your treatment guidebook, your clinical manual for the GI section. You can read all about each of these virulence factors and what we know about them. But we did get a change, and the other thing to look for is to look at the other thing is the resistance, and so we see that there's potentially some resistance to one of the antibiotics, but we're not using that, so that's less pertinent to us.
So we also see that the fecal fat has elevated, so showing a different side of digestive problems. Now we're seeing fat in the stool, basically.
Then we see positive on Candida. So, you know, again, we didn't have that before. And interestingly, we did an approach for the Aspergillus that is similar to an approach that we would use for Candida, and then we found it on the post-testing. So think to yourself, why would we find these things? Why would we see H. pylori still there with a couple of extra virulence factors? Why would we see a change in fecal fat? And why might we see a positive on Candida after some treatment here? So just think for a moment, and we'll give you our thoughts as well.
So, and this is where it gets even more exciting and interesting, is look at this doctor's data, this post-treatment doctor's data. Now we're seeing a few of the endolymax. We're seeing the cysts and instead of the trophs in that sample two, but we see when we get down to sample three, we see both cysts, both trophs. We see Diatomeba fragilis, we see Blastocystis hominis, we see yeast. So we've actually gone up two different species of parasites. So that's really, really interesting. What the heck is happening here?
Now, of course, we sort of naturally want to be asking, did you do some international travel or eat some unclean food or drink some unclean water between these times? Of course, we want to do that, but that wasn't really a factor in this case. And so what else might be the cause here of this very interesting thing? Because we did a parasite protocol, and why would there be more parasites? And remember also that we were doing leaky gut as a part of our treatment. So that could clue you in a little bit to what might be happening here.
So that's where we are with this particular case. We basically started this person. We changed up the protocol a little bit. We started, you know, further treating all of these microorganisms, and then up the leaky gut protocol, and that was about 2 months ago. So currently where he's at right now is retaking all of these tests, and we're gonna see where we're at.
And so our thoughts on what's happening here is that as leaky gut's healing up, that there may be some shift in the intestinal crypts, and you know, there's not solid research for this, so this is a little bit theoretical, but we put this in the GI handout, and we talked a bit about it in the module, where we sometimes do see, interestingly, that we do treatment, like a parasite treatment followed by a leaky gut treatment. And then we wait and we retest, and sometimes we see additional parasites. And so that's something that it's not super common. It doesn't happen all the time, but especially when there's a high degree of leaky gut, tends to be a little more common. So there may be something deeper that we're accessing now that we hadn't been able to access before we did some gut repair. And so it may be that we're seeing a deeper layer of some things that may have already been there, but were able to be a little bit more in hiding while the gut was more damaged. So this is something that if you encounter, that you don't need to get sort of discouraged that the treatment didn't work, because we see changes. We don't see the exact same thing. So sometimes when we see changes in a certain direction that's not an expected direction, there can be some progress happening. And so we want to sort of just consider whether it may be that there's a healing of the gut that's happening, of the gut barrier, the gut lining, that's allowing for these parasites to be better shed into the stool.
So, and then just wanted to, you know, reemphasize that this is not something that we are seeing in research. This idea of parasites showing up later because they've been hidden in the crypts and the crypts are healing. And, you know, now people are, you know, having these parasites here. It was taught to us originally by our mentor, Dr. Kalish. And, you know, and certainly when we run tests and we see things like this clinically, that is definitely what we start to think, because, I mean, it just seems so logical. And it's always possible, right, that stool cultures miss stuff. There's not tests out there that are 100% specific, 100% sensitive, 100% of the time. So, you know, we get these, it does show up in the research that there's not tests that are perfect. So it's possible things are missed. But, you know, we see this often enough that that stool cultures are different, or we, especially in this sort of case where it's like we're having multiple new infections show up later. And to me and to us, it's a sign that instead of saying like, oh, this, you know, this lab company must be wrong, that there might not actually be parasites in the stool in the beginning versus now. That in order for them to be found in the stool, they have to be shed. And remember that when we look through several of these microorganisms, virulence, that they have ways of burrowing in our tissues, of changing and altering our immune system, so it will help them survive. And part of this could be burying themselves in the intestinal crypts so that they're not going to come out in the stool and be found, you know, especially when we're in this inflammatory state.
So that wraps up this case. Complicated case, challenging case, one that's good to show you because you may encounter these atypical, challenging cases that you're kind of left with this muddled sense of what's happening here. And so, so we don't always know exactly what's happening, but we do know that we do see these sorts of cases. And so it's good to know that they happen and that we have some theory about what might be going on, and that this is an area that we hope to see more research on in the future so that we can have a clearer sense for being able to tell people with more specificity what's happening. But for now, we can explain that this does happen from time to time, offer our clinical theory, and then continue on with treatment and see how it goes. Next case.
So our second case comes in, and his original symptoms were really just intestinal diarrhea and bloating and fatigue.
So this would be what we'd consider to be mostly a simple case, something that frequently we may be able to work through in a shorter period of time with a little bit less testing than some of the more complex cases. But as we saw before, the last client came in with no symptoms, and we ended up diving really deep into doing a lot of testing and finding a lot of things. So we never know. So let's see what we find here.
So no surprise with the diarrhea and the bloating that we would run a stool culture. So We do. And the biggest thing we find here is we have H. pylori positive. So we have some H. pylori that are found, resistance to clarithromycin, but we're not going to use that antibiotic in our treatment anyway, so no problem there.
We do see a high anti-gliadin, IgA, which we don't really see in the research to be a very reliable marker, unfortunately, in the stool. So some clinicians will take that to mean that a person's gluten sensitive and get them off gluten. It might not be a bad idea to get them off gluten anyway. So I frequently will recommend that someone get off gluten, but I will not tell them that they are for sure sensitive to gluten based on just a stool IgA. I want to run an additional test, something like the Wheat Zoomer, to look at non-celiac gluten sensitivity or some of the celiac markers or both, and be able to assess it that way for giving someone more of a sense for whether they're gluten sensitive. So, you know, this can be something that maybe is a respectable motivator for people who are able to sort of need a little bit of convincing to get off gluten. And if we think that, you know, they've gotten leaky gut and inflammation and we would like them to get off gluten for the treatment period, this could be a motivator, although I'd be careful with drawing too solid of a conclusion from an anti-gliadin IgA marker.
So we see that the rest of the test is normal. So we're not seeing any parasites, any fungus on this test.
When we looked at the Dutch test for adrenals, we see here, interestingly, that DHEA is not only functionally low, but low by lab reference range standards. So we see this DHEA value 51 below that 60. So definitely something worth addressing here and may be part of the contribution towards fatigue. We also see that the total metabolized cortisol is healthy in range towards the lower half of the range, but definitely in that nice window for the range. Then when we look down towards the free cortisol pattern, we see that on waking, the response is low. So this is telling us a little bit about when the cortisol awakening response is blunted. That's something that definitely we are going to begin to think about chronic stress being affecting the cortisol response. And so interestingly for him, the waking response is the below range one. And then the morning time, he gets almost towards the upper end of the range. Afternoon, he's towards the upper end of the range. And night, he's even a little high in range. So his total free cortisol is actually on the upper half. But that awakening response is low there. So that makes us think there's definitely something with stress, and DHEA levels getting up will for sure help. And then if we can get that cortisol awakening response working a little better, perhaps with some sunlight plus some supplementation, sunlight first thing in the morning, 30 minutes, be great, plus some supplementation. And there may be a bit of a delayed circadian rhythm in this case, since we see that nighttime value elevated, and then we see the waking value low, but then he gets up fairly quickly. There may be a delayed response, and he may be the kind of person who naturally might do a little better with staying up a little later at night, waking up a little later in the morning, which may or may not be healthy and may or may not work with his life schedule and with others in his life. So it's something that we may want to help with shifting the timing of the curve of the circadian rhythm for helping that awakening response to be pushed a little earlier and the sleep response and the lowering of the cortisol to be pushed a little earlier as well.
And then, of course, with the diarrhea and especially the bloating, we looked at small intestinal bacteria overgrowth. And we see here that for hydrogens, remembering we're looking for any single value greater than 20, provided that baseline is normal. And we have a normal baseline, And we do have that 27. So we see that 27 at the 90-minute mark. So that's letting us know that, yes, there is hydrogen type of bacteria here, hydrogen producers. And then remember, for the methane, we're ignoring that baseline. And what we're looking here or here is anything 12 or greater. And so we also see a 13. So we learned here that we have both hydrogen and methane type of SIBO. Another thing that, just to remind you guys, is what's happening at this 120 mark. So we see there's no data there. And this happens when something happens to the sample. Either patient didn't package it right and the glass vial broke on the way to the lab, or more commonly, the breathing was not done right, the technique was not done right, and they've sucked in air from the surrounding room, the atmospheric air, and that's actually contaminated the sample. So, you know, if we didn't have this 27 and we didn't have the 13 here, we would actually not know if this was a positive test, because we couldn't totally rule, or we wouldn't know for sure if it was a negative test, even if there was no positive numbers in either one of these categories, because we couldn't rule the test out as being SIBO without having the numbers here. So luckily in this case, it doesn't matter because we already see the 27 under hydrogen, the 13 under methane. And so we know we can just call this a positive case and move on.
When we look also at the liver markers and kidney markers on a blood test, we see that the ALT is at 38, which, although it's in the lab reference range, that's a little bit functionally high above 30. We're thinking, you know, well, that might be something to consider there. And other than that, the liver markers all look reasonable. So we're not thinking it's, you know, necessarily a huge issue, but something to be watching out for is over 30 on the ALT and AST. And then in the kidney markers, we do see cystatin C being high, which is generally related to kidney. It can in some cases be related to heart. But when we see this EGFR being 56, that's pretty low. So we're considering probably the cystatin C is a little more related to kidney, because we see it together with the low EGFR, the glomerular filtration rate. So that's something that we want to definitely look at, and something that we definitely want to treat. Why are the kidneys inflamed? And so that's something that is, you know, can become serious if it goes too far. So we really want to deal with it now while the creatinine is still in range and the bun still looks good, so that we can help prevent future issues. Because, of course, as we know, the kidney is vitally important for our health and for so many functions in the body.
So what we did for treatment for this patient was we put him on the CU SIBO, that herbal formula that we've created that has a bunch of herbs that have the energetics of Chinese medicine for clearing damp and heat in the middle jaw, that have berberines to help kill off the SIBO, as well as herbs in there that are guiding herbs that help guide the other herbs, the antimicrobial herbs, to the small intestine where SIBO, of course, is located. So put them on that, put them on some allicin, because there was a small amount of that methane type SIBO, which we know allicin is so important for. We did Prescriptisys, which is that 50% spore-based probiotic. We are putting more of our SIBO patients on Megaspore now, but when we actually had this case, we did not know about that product yet, but we are leaning towards that now just because it's 100% spore-based. People with SIBO seem to tolerate it really, really well. And there's some good research about it also working to heal leaky gut, which, of course, is something to consider with SIBO. We also did gut flora complex, which is that enteric oil of oregano that will bypass the stomach, making itself all the way to the intestinal tract. Adrenal support to help pull up that low DHEA that, you know, certainly appearing adrenal rhythm issues. And then the plan for the kidney was to retest after other work was done. And this is what we'll do a lot of times if we'll see a place in the body that seems to be mildly inflamed, not much of a problem yet. And, you know, when we're seeing the cause of inflammation in another part of the body. So, you know, the idea is that, you know, I haven't personally seen any research that's like, oh, yeah, SIBO can cause kidney inflammation. But I know that cytokines, that chemokines, that all these different inflammatory markers are systemic, that they do travel in our blood, in our lymph to get places. So it's always worth considering, especially if we have another place of inflammation that we found, and the inflammation, say, in another location, like the kidneys in this location, isn't too dysregulated or a problem, it's always worth considering to actually hold off on, say, treatment in the one area and really work with what seems like part of the root of the problem, like SIBO in this case, to see if that will alleviate some of the things we're seeing on the labs. The other big reason for this is simply just supplement tolerance. And, you know, we would see SIBO, gut flora complex, it's like Allicin, like some of the, you know, these GI protocols are multiple pills multiple times a day. So that's oftentimes something we take into consideration too when we're seeing something like this is it really seeming that it would benefit the patient greatly to get it in now? Or does it seem like it's so minor that holding off on treatment for a few months might resolve on its own, but if not, there's not going to be much change and damage to whatever area we're talking about. And here, that's kind of what we're deciding of, like, there's a lot of supplements for this person. We could, you know, possibly switch it just by treating this inflammation. So let's hold off. Let's do this treatment. We'll come back and we'll retest later and we'll see if it's still there. And if it is, then we'll do more targeted approaches towards the kidneys themselves.
So post-treatment, here's the SIBO post-test. So if we can see that the hydrogen baseline is 4, so it still did a good prep diet, and no subsequent value of 20 or greater, which means, yay, hydrogen, SIBO looks like it's gone. For methane, we see no values over 12, and since he doesn't have constipation, his chief complaint was always diarrhea on loose end, we're not considering that a positive if it's anything less than 12. So this is a cleared SIBO post-test. So great job. He was feeling great. He reported that things, digestion was much better. He still had the tendency, if he was going to go one direction with stool, towards loose, but not watery, not diarrhea anymore. And it was much, much better, definitely tolerable. And so, you know, he wasn't putting out a type 4 on the Bristol stool scale every single time. So there may be something else that needs to happen in order to build up his digestive resources, which we really love Chinese medicine for that. And some of the Chinese herbal formulas are fantastic for building up that digestive fire and energy over time. And so that might be a consideration here. But we do see that we resolved one of the major issues, which was small intestinal bacterial overgrowth.
And for those of you who don't practice Chinese medicine, you know, other things that you can always consider in these cases are the basic things. You know, it's like peeling the leaky gut, look for things such as pancreatic enzyme deficiency, bile deficiency, HCL deficiency, you know, see if there's any, you know, consider any sort of muscular adhesions, do methods such as Mayan abdominal massage possibly need to come into play. What are people's emotions? How are people eating? Those basic hygiene thing is, you know, the diarrhea is still there in this minuscule amount just because somebody's not practicing good food hygiene or because they're eating when they're emotional or they're upset, which we know is not good for digestion. So there's definitely a lot of things that we can do in regards to healing up this last little bit of diarrhea. We're not seeing any pathogens anymore that can still help to tonify the tissue, to remove any of that residual leaky gut, and to really begin to work on the mind components that could be contributing here.
And then, of course, we can always consider Saccharomyces boulardii, which in some cases can help with diarrhea and or loose stool. So that's a probiotic to be considering for ongoing use. And also another one to consider is a lifestyle change where we know that for a lot of people, caffeine can loosen stool. So for people with propensity towards loose stool, if we can reduce or eliminate even caffeine use, that can sometimes firm up the stool nicely.
So, and then this was the repeat Vibrance afterwards. So still looking at the kidney section, we still see that the cystatin C and the EGFR are still very, you know, out of balance. Cystatin C is high, GFR is low. And so we do see some kidney inflammation still. So at this point, this particular client has been pulled from all the SIBO protocol. We're really just working on leaky gut and some Chinese things to build up that digestive energy. And then we're also using a few different things for kidney tonics. So some of our favorite kidney tonics are NAC, carnitine, and vitamin A.
And then the Free the MMC is our formula for migrating motor complex, getting that working again. That's especially pertinent in this case because we saw the elevation of hydrogen in the original SIBO lab to be at the 90-minute mark. So the elevation being a little closer to the ileum tells us that it may be a type of SIBO that's affected by the migrating motor complex, not flushing bacteria into the large intestine. So the large intestine bacteria may be creeping into the small intestine and overgrowing. That may be the root. Part of how the pathogenesis works for that is, we go into a lot more detail in the SIBO course, but is food poisoning at some point leading to a toxin damaging the nervous system, creating antivinculin antibodies that then look like they're essentially creating a dysfunction in the migrating motor complex. And so we have an herbal formula that helps to have that, to get that back in balance by working to stimulate the peristaltic activity in the evening time, especially before bed. So we'll generally give that in the evening before bed. And another product that tends to work well, two more, are Iberogast and Modal Pro. So those are two other options on stimulating the migrating motor complex. So a third case. And in this case, we're looking at someone who also, diarrhea is the chief complaint. And there's, in this case, a definite need for and work on losing weight. Weight management has been a big struggle for this person, an ongoing struggle for many, many years. And there's chronic fatigue and depression as well. So these are some of the main issues that are things that are worth assessing and addressing. And so we're going to look at doing testing for some of the obvious GI digestive things, and also for looking at what ways can we find some of the root causes for the chronic fatigue and depression as well.
I just want to actually go back for a second, actually to the last case before we move on, or before we continue on, just to mention a couple different things about this kidney support. And one is, these are what we've seen to be so good. We see these three things change kidney inflammation in the lab so well, but we always want to use them each cautiously for different reasons. So NAC, and we mentioned this in the gut module, that NAC as a mucolytic, it's even though it helps kidney inflammation, it does break down mucus. And we have a mucus layer in our intestinal tract. So it's always something to consider is, as a mucolytic, is NAC actually breaking down that mucus layer? And if it does that, is it actually irritating the health of our digestive tract? So that's something to just consider. We still use it. We just always use it like cautiously and make sure that's not something that we're putting into people in large quantities, you know, for long, long periods of time because of that. Carnitine has been shown all over the research to make thyroid problems worse. And I've also seen this clinically, of putting somebody that had borderline hypothyroidism, put them on carnitine I believe it was for fat metabolism, if I remember correctly, and then retesting labs, and absolutely thyroid went low. And this patient, within like 2 days of being on carnitine, called me and said, "Hey, I think this is happening." We tested her labs, you know, soon after that, and it was indeed low. So, you know, just a point of caution, because fatigue is so common in people, and thyroid uh, hypothyroidism being, you know, such a common reason for that, that if we do have somebody with fatigue and we see them come up with kidney inflammation, we really want to make sure that we are actually getting those labs run for like a full thyroid panel run to say, okay, their thyroid's safe, their thyroid looks good, we can now put them on carnitine. And then the vitamin A is going to be really important to realize that vitamin A in high doses can cause liver inflammation. So most of what I've seen as far as the liver inflammation tends to happen around 100,000 IUs a day. So it's significant. And the only time that Miles and I tend to prescribe that high is when we're watching the liver enzymes closely. And when we are actually fighting, we're actually helping somebody with a viral infection, because vitamin A is pretty amazing for fighting viruses, but it can also be helpful for kidneys. So, you know, tend to keep people more on like a 30 or 40,000 IU, still with some awareness around the liver in this situation. So somebody has any sort of liver inflammation, we might want to think about using one of these other two nutrients and or testing the, you know, using a smaller dose of vitamin A and testing the liver enzymes as we go.
And just one more interesting note about carnitine is that it's potentially a cause of and an exacerbator of fatigue. So I want to say it's potentially a solution to or an exacerbator for fatigue. If the cause of fatigue is unrelated to the thyroid and the thyroid is doing really well, but they're not making energy from fats as well, then carnitine can be an amazing solution for fatigue, because carnitine is necessary for as a cofactor for fat to make it into the mitochondria to be converted to energy. So in those cases, when fat metabolism is something that's one of the main causes for fatigue and thyroid is normal, carnitine can really help fatigue. And simultaneously, if hypothyroid or even subclinical hypothyroid is a cause of fatigue, then carnitine may worsen it. So we have to just play that have that balance, look at the labs, look at the thyroid, assess fat metabolism, and then weigh those options when we're looking at carnitine. NAC, of course, then is, in addition to helping with kidney inflammation, also a biofilm disruptor. So in some cases it can help with dealing with things like bacterial overgrowth or candida overgrowth. And another function of NAC, of course, is also as a precursor to glutathione. And so for people who are able to make enough glutathione with NAC, it can help to increase glutathione levels. And of course, we know that can be a significant factor for helping with a whole variety and host of liver issues, oxidative damage, and other things. So we've got a question about carnitine.
So the question is, why is carnitine harmful if thyroid dysfunction is present? And I'm trying to remember the mechanism here. I believe the mechanism was something to do with thyroid hormone not being able to bind to the cells, like T4 or T3 not being able to bind to the cells correctly. So it was at the receptor level.
I'm pretty sure that's correct. It's something to do with the receptor binding sites.
So we still, and that's a problem, right? Because we can actually still see normal T3 and normal T4, but other things like T3 uptake, for example, can tell us something about the receptor site. So it might be valuable to look for T3 uptake in these people. And that's also why it's really important to let all of our patients know, our clients know, that, oh, there could be some potential problems with using this. And, you know, we're going to talk to you guys in the clinical communication module about how to let people know things like that without, you know, making kind of a hypnotic suggestion to them that they're actually going to get that particular condition. But we want to, you know, basically make them aware that this is a possibility, just in case we're not running labs right away, that they're kind of watching for it too. I mean, you know, changes in energy, changes in weights are things that, most people notice pretty quickly. So having that extra layer of awareness is definitely a helpful thing.
Then when we look at the dried urine test for hormones, in this case, so we're moving on to this third case that we started on. So this third case, diarrhea, need for weight loss, chronic fatigue and depression. So new case. Looking at the dried urine test for complete hormones, we see in this case that there's a decrease in DHEA. It's towards the low end of normal, which definitely we want to see it higher than 60, even though this is a woman, but we do want to see it higher than 60. So functionally low DHEA. And then total metabolized cortisol, definitely above the high end of the reference range. So in this case, an overactive cortisol response, metabolized cortisol response. And in this particular case, remember we're looking at weight loss being or weight gain being a chief complaint. So weight is, adipose tissue is one thing that can elevate the metabolized cortisol output. And we'll get into more details about the mechanism of how that works in the adrenal course, but it has to do with an enzyme that converts cortisone into cortisol, and that basically happens in adipose tissue at a higher level than other cells and tissue in the body. So that HSD enzyme definitely will, in many people who are overweight and have excessive cortisol, metabolized cortisol, be the cause of that issue.
So, and we'll go through that in much more detail in the adrenal section, just throwing this out there so you guys can kind of start hearing this and getting some of these mechanisms into your brain and just making you familiar with them. Also, just want to throw in here that when we were talking at the beginning about this being showing you guys one of our really challenging cases, this is the one that we are talking about. So this woman is so dramatically overweight, and it's really affecting her life and her well-being, and bleeding into social life and just normal wellness. So and usually with a lot of the things that we're going to look at in her case, these are a lot of the things that we tend to look at in people when we have difficult cases. So, but when we're not seeing that this stuff is working, we just wanted to show you guys some of the things that we start looking at next that are just a little bit more out of, out of the box, so to speak.
So when we look a little further at the Dutch test, we can see in the free cortisol that we've got the waking response being in the low end of normal, morning being smack dab in the middle, afternoon being low end of normal, night elevating high. Overall, free cortisol is somewhere in the middle. But we know that she feels fatigue and depression is a complaint. And so we can tell that there's a sense of that the energy levels aren't where they're at. But it may not be primarily a cortisol issue. The only time where we see the low cortisol may be contributing to fatigue is this afternoon value and this morning value. Sort of a mild fatigue could be a possibility from these results, but we're definitely still on the search for what might be the reason for her fatigue in this case. And so low DHEA is something that we're definitely wanting to pay attention to and work on. That high night cortisol and that high metabolized cortisol are something that we'd like to work on, although for the high metabolized cortisol, that's something that we may have to do some weight loss before that's going to come in.
So, of course, bringing us back to inflammation. So, remember that anything that in the inflammatory pathway that's going to upregulate NF-kappa B is going to be a huge problem with creating inflammation. So NF-kappa B and inflammation go hand in hand, And what we see is that it's practically impossible to lose weight with NF-kappa B being high. So basically, once NF-kappa B is like raised, it will change adipose tissue. And it'll do it in a couple ways. The first way being, it will actually cause adipose tissue to grow, to multiply. And then secondly, it'll cause adipose tissue to actually swell. And the swelling, what that allows it to do is it allows the adipose tissue to actually store more fat. So, you know, when we're dealing with weight, when we're dealing with anything in an inflammatory scenario, we always want to say, where is the inflammation coming from? And so much inflammation comes from her gut. On top of that, she has some pretty major diarrhea. So, you know, we want us to start looking into her gastrointestinal tract so we would know, what we were dealing with. So Miles is drawing NF kappa B on the whiteboard so you guys can see that. And then what we found here was a positive H. pylori infection.
And then NF kappa beta can lead to the swelling, the adipose tissue. So that inflammatory cascade is something that we really, really need to be aware of in this case so that we can begin to work with getting that under control. So H. pylori positive. High anti-gliadin IgA, which again, not a definitive marker on gluten, but we'll see later that this person indeed needs strict avoidance for gluten. Fecal fat was high, so that's something to consider what's going on with fat metabolism. And SIGA, the second sample, was high, so there's some sort of an immune response in the gut there.
So, and then we made, we haven't put them on the back dashboard yet, but we have made several videos for you guys, just as extra bonus material. One is about SIGA. So the SIGA video, make sure you watch it because we're going to go through salivary versus fecal. We're going to talk about functional ranges. We're going to talk about what we're seeing in the research as far as being ideal ways of testing versus other ways. So we'll go over that. We have one going through peristalsis versus the MMC in a lot bigger detail. And then a third one going over monolaurin, because monolaurin is not something that we've spent a lot of time talking about with the gut module, but the research on monolaurin is really great. So make sure you guys are kind of just looking out for those and check them out when they do come out.
No parasites, no fungi. However, when we look at the organic acids test, now this is one that you know, you may be unfamiliar with right now, and so it's something that don't sort of get hung up on it, just sort of let it wash over. We just want to introduce you to a lot of these tests that you may not already be doing, so you can see how we take a small picture and make it into a big picture and get a lot of information and assess that. So we see two high values. We see that p-hydroxyphenylacetate is high, and then we see that D-lactate is high. So D-lactate being high can sometimes indicate an overgrowth, like a small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, for example. So that's something that we may be considering, although we did a SIBO breath test with this person that came up negative. So this is something that we wonder about, and we're thinking, well, there may be, we see in the urine metabolites that indicate to us that some of the strains of bacteria, particularly the acidophilus type, may be growing a little more than expected. But we don't know where or why exactly, and the breath test, usually we lean on a little more than the organic acids test to give us accurate assessment of SIBO, although we're definitely curious seeing this result.
So things that we've seen on this page with the organics that are fairly common and that we've actually treated off of would, you know, specifically would be the clostridial species and the yeast. So clostridial species, I believe we gave you an example in the module of somebody who had a pretty severe autoimmune condition, dermatomyositis, and with that, we had seen tons of different microorganisms come up, but the stool was clean for clostridia. But the organics, we did find this clostridial here, and we did wind up doing a treatment for C. diff, which involved the Esculardi that we've talked about. And remember that Esculardi really helps with the toxin, with the C. diff toxin. So helps basically the toxins lose their attachment to the cell wall so we can flush those out and those toxins are no longer inflaming us. And with this particular patient, we saw dramatic shift in her autoimmunity with this particular part of the treatment. It was like within...
And you specify that's not this patient that we're looking at her lab right now.
Correct.
With the patient that she was just talking about that we mentioned in the GI lab.
Correct. So with that particular patient, we did see when we treated the C. diff with the Esculardi, or treated the toxins at least, that symptoms dramatically improved. You know, somebody that couldn't run, that could hardly even stand up in the shower, was now running, was now taking showers, was now going skiing. All we got 10% increment changes with a lot of the other microorganisms we treated. But when we started treating the C. diff, that the differences we saw were probably, it was probably like a 50 to 60% improvement versus these tiny little changes. So it was really significant. And so the same thing with the yeast. Sometimes we'll see yeast show up on the organics and not in other places. And for the yeast, we definitely tend to say, okay, this is, you know, definitely present, even if we didn't see it in the stools, and common to have yeast in the stool miss. And so if either of those, these are positive, we do generally go ahead with the prospective treatments.
Because in this, we do see the hydroxyphenyl acetate high and the D-lactate high, you know, this is an indicator. The hydroxyphenyl acetate is an indicator that there is some bacteria that's potentially sort of having some impact somewhere. Doesn't tell us necessarily where, but somewhere there might be some bacteria. So between these two, it may be worthwhile to investigate some antimicrobial approach. We just don't know exactly where or how, so that's something that is a little ambiguous and vague for us to be as solid in our assessment as we'd like to be. But it's something to go off of, and with a really tough case, sometimes we just need somewhere to go.
Okay, and then the last thing to say about that last slide with the bacteria, seeing that hydroxyphenyl acetate there that's elevated, is that we did see, remember on the stool culture, we did see that H. pylori. So we did find an H. pylori sample, H. pylori through the PCR DNA. So, you know, when we come to the organics later and we see the hydroxyphenyl acetate that is elevated with bacteria, it's entirely possible that the H. pylori is what drove that up. It's also possible that there's something else. We just don't know.
So we did run her C-bone. Like I mentioned before, she came up as being normal, no indicator of C-bone. Now, hydrogen, when we look at hydrogen in this lab, we see 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. It's a little bit dubious, and if we saw one more zero, or even a 1 or a 2 at the 120-minute mark, we may very well be thinking hydrogen sulfide as a possibility, especially if they're sulfur-smelling gas.
And we could even consider that with this patient, remember, because she has diarrhea. So remember, her transit time is going to be faster. So it's possible this 120 that we're actually even dealing with that lactulose drink making itself all the way to the colon. So it's definitely going to be something that we at least want to consider. And, you know, possibly doing a short-term SIBO treatment for somebody like this could be a good idea, just to see if any symptoms change.
So, and I believe we did do some SIBO treatment here. So,
and I don't think anything changed, if I remember correctly, with our SIBO.
So, celiac and gluten sensitivity in a blood panel, we see anti-trans tissue glutaminase IgA and IgG elevated. And so this definitely does indicate a gluten sensitivity. To get the celiac diagnosis, a person would go in for a biopsy, but usually that's not necessary because we see even when there's not visible damage in a biopsy, but there are elevated tissue transglutaminase values. There's a big study that showed that they took people with these elevated values and they put them into two groups, one group that had a positive biopsy, one the group that had a negative biopsy. The positive biopsy, they told that group that you have celiac and you need to strictly avoid gluten. The group that had a negative biopsy but had these values elevated, they said, well, you don't have celiac, so I guess you can eat gluten. But they had these elevated, and they found higher incidence of hypothyroidism, osteoporosis, and a couple other conditions. So we definitely see that it's probably wise to advocate strict avoidance of gluten based alone off of tissue transglutaminase elevations. So since we see those elevations, we advise strict avoidance of gluten in this case. And she did notice, although she wasn't eating much gluten, she wasn't being super rigid and strict about it. And every once in a while, she'd have a little, and she wasn't aware of cross-contamination when she was eating out. So she did find some improvement when she became more strict in her avoidance of gluten.
And remember here that, you know, the tissue transglutaminases, they are actually highly correlated in the research with celiac. So there's that huge correlation. So absolutely, this could be celiac disease. We just don't know for sure if that's at the level of the gold standard of diagnosing is that biopsy and really seeing that tissue has changed itself. And without doing that, we don't really know. Yes, this could be celiac. Yes, it could be gluten sensitivity. We're not really sure which. But there is enough of a correlation with the tissue transglutaminases and then other research like Miles is talking about where, you know, those that were positive or negative for the celiac disease with the biopsy to, you know, say confirm a test like this, that it's in either group is really good and really important to stay away from gluten. So I generally, you know, tell people, you know, in this situation of like, you know, try to express the seriousness of this to them and let them know that that they're very, very, very reactive to gluten, and it could be celiac, it could not be, but it certainly is reason enough because of the level, the sensitivity to avoid gluten and take it like really seriously to the next level and not just act like they have gluten sensitivity, but to act in a lot of ways like they have celiac disease, because with this sort of test, they very well could. And unless they want to go and get the biopsy, you know, the next best thing is, if we don't know, is really to take this seriously and treat it like celiac disease.
And we can also do a 23andMe or other genetic testing and look at HLA, DQ markers, and that can help to strengthen the argument for gluten being a significant issue if a person needs a little more evidence to warrant their avoidance of gluten.
So other things we found, the ST2, this test unfortunately is not being performed by Vibrant America anymore, but this particular test tends to elevate when there's a lot of myocardial stress, and it's an extremely early predictor of a myocardial infarction, or it suggests extremely early sensitive marker to an MI. So she was definitely at high risk here, so we definitely want to take that seriously. And then we see that the SDLDLs, the small dense LDLs, are also elevated. Those small dense LDLs, along with another LDL called oxidized LDL, are what we see in the research to be the most damaging to the arterial walls, to be the most damaging to the cardiac health itself. So
within the LDL.
Within the LDL category.
Yeah.
Right. So basically, when we're looking at you know, these numbers here, this, you know, this 67, we need to take this seriously. Even if LDL, HDL, total cholesterol was normal, seeing that, you know, there's a higher arterial risk, seeing that there is this elevated ST2, we definitely want to support the cardiac system.
And then LPA we have to consider separately from other cholesterol markers. It's an independent risk factor. Even if everything else is normal, we don't kind of just factor it into a bigger picture of looking at it in relation to and weighing it against other markers, we have to consider it its own independent risk factor, because we see in the research that it's, even if other things are normal, can indeed have a level of risk for cardiovascular illness from an elevated LPA. So for LPA, we see that that's elevated, and sometimes that's it has a genetic component to it. We can definitely get it down using supplements and nutrition and lifestyle. So it can be slow to change, but we do see it change, and we have seen it change many times. And so we can definitely help that. Some of the things that tend to help that are things like niacin, carnitine, and vitamin C are three of the biggest researched substances for helping lower LPA values.
So, and this test was extremely helpful for us. So this company is Alitest, and they do IgG testing, some IgE testing. And one of the things they have is this mold panel. They're actually looking for, these are all different mold toxins. So we run this test. It's a little bit different than looking for mycotoxins, which is a little bit more classically used in the mold world. Challenge with mycotoxin testing is the initial out-of-pocket patient cost without any upcharge is $750. And they're only looking for three different mycotoxins. So here we get 15, and we're in a certain sense, we're looking for a different thing. The mycotoxin test is saying, is there a presence of a toxin? This is saying, are you having an IgG immune reaction to a toxin? So to us, if our body is creating an immune reaction to this mold toxin, that's a sign that the mold's actually in our body and we're having a problem with it. The out-of-pocket patient costs, the actual, we get charged as practitioners, something like, do you remember? It's very low. It's a very low cost test for our clients. It's, I think, 20% or so of what the mycotoxin test is. So this can be a great alternative for people. We get a lot of great information. You know, and certainly what we're looking at here is we see all these ones in red, and all the ones in red are basically showing immune reactivity. They're rated between negative, meaning no immune activity, all the way up to 4 for a lot of immune activity. So, you know, we're seeing that there's a couple of the funguses and molds that she's having a 3, several 2s, and some 1. So certainly mold is, for this particular client, something that is really affecting her and that we want to address.
And then when we looked at a genetic test that's a very sort of complex sequencing test that sequences the genome and looks for specific mutations and dysfunctions, they didn't find any variants that they could solidly say have any potential benefits, although they did find one gene that doesn't make a protein, but they don't know what that protein's function is. It's not clear enough in the research, so we couldn't make a solid link with that to any of her disease processes, but it may be a role, we just don't know, unfortunately.
So the way that company, we haven't been using that company, that Cortigen, that much, we just wanted to show this to you guys. So you know that it is out there. They describe it as being different than, say, the 23andMe, because instead of just looking for an individual SNP, an individual polymorphism, they're actually looking at an entire gene, and they're trying to isolate, oh, this abnormality in this entire gene versus this one portion of it, this one nucleotide, is basically correlated with some of the patient's symptoms. And we didn't actually elicit any results from this for this patient.
We also did Gut Pack by Vibrant America to look at some of the microbiome activity to see if there was anything there that might be something that would be indicating or helping us to point us in the right direction for treatment. So we did find a decrease in Bifidobacterium lactis, and we found just a little bit of slightly low in the Lactobacillus plantarum. And those two are the two that we saw that were slightly changed or altered from normal that can contribute to leaky gut
Well, and actually what's interesting about this is really the abundance of any of these that are associated with leaky gut. So
okay, so just had a little internet connectivity issue, but we're back.
So just to review that we do see a problem here. I mean, certainly we think that, yes, having low levels of these could absolutely contribute to leaky gut. We see that low levels are so indicative of the research with, not being able to help us with, say, activating vitamins and minerals or contributing to our immunity. But it's interesting in like some of the research done by Vibrant and their gut pack, they're actually seeing that abundance, like overabundance of some of these can actually be associated with leaky gut syndrome. So definitely something to consider there. And just to show you a little bit more about this test, how it really works is there are some pathogenic species that are on here. A lot of the species that are basically going to be on here are going to be also be either commensals or normal flora. And what this test does, it kind of helps elicit for us of like, is there something going on with the microbiome that's contributing to some of the symptoms that we have, that this woman has?
So we see just one that's out of the reference range here. And that's one that I'm not even going to try to pronounce, but we'll just highlight it for you so you can see. And so it's this one here, Silvo Vibro Iger, something like that. And so that one is out of range, and the association for this whole grouping is potentially with IBS, and for this whole grouping is potentially with IBD. But no sort of major things that we're seeing here.
And then other things we see here are some abnormalities in Bifidobacterium lactis, as well as some abnormalities in Lactobacillus plantarum.
And interestingly, since Lactobacillus plantarum is associated with atherosclerosis and triglyceride levels have been a big struggle for this patient. So even with eating very, very little carbohydrate, she's just struggled to have very high triglyceride levels. They've come down gradually over time, but they're still in this higher than optimal range. And so we do see that the Lactobacillus plantarum does have some research for being associated with those triglyceride levels. And with atherosclerosis, we saw those markers that were associated with cardiovascular illness. So that's something that we definitely do want to play a role. And for the high LDL cholesterol with the Bifidobacterium lactis, we saw that the small dense LDLs were a little bit higher. So these are the Bifidobacterium and the Lactobacillus plantarum are two that we're thinking, okay, well maybe, these are ones that are available in probiotics. So maybe a multi-strain probiotic is applicable in this case. So you may be looking at that for her.
So other possibilities here of things out of balance are Lactobacillus, found some Yersinia, found some decrease of acromasia. So, just looking for things that are abnormal here that could lead us to, really just determining that a huge portion of this is coming from a microbiome issue.
We were actually really surprised not to see more come up on the obesity, since weight management's been such a struggle for her, even with good diet. So that was a little bit strange. We were kind of really looking for seeing changes in these bacteria for part of our explanation behind the difficulty with weight loss, but we didn't interestingly see it in this case.
So just one more here. So these are just more lists of the same that you hopefully you can get a sense now of just the ways we can use this to kind of make associations and correlations with the gut microbiome to particular diseases.
And so again, we see Lactobacillus plantarum being associated with wrinkling and skin-related issues and aging effects. And then we see Ruminococcus being depleted and that being associated with high fragility aging. We also reviewed some of the 23andMe. We're going to kind of go pretty quick through this because it's something that we can't, we're not going to, you know, have a module on or focus too much on, but we do see that some of her histamine breakdown, histamine clearing genetics are a little bit impaired.
And that's, you know, important for her in part because we're trying to find inflammation and we know it's here. Where is it? And so we're seeing that, okay, this histamine, you know, can be an inflammatory molecule in our body. And so she, you know, because of these SNPs, if they're activated, it could be a problem for her to actually detox that histamine.
We do see potential for depleted carnitine or lower carnitine production because some of the enzymes that help to produce carnitine and some of the genetics, we do see some SNPs in. So we are definitely, based on this, looking at and considering carnitine to be something to consider with the caveat of looking into thyroid also with that.
So in the ACAT, another fatty acid metabolism marker, certainly another consideration with using something like carnitine.
But notice the single most relevant polymorphism was not found. So it was in other genes, but not in the one that has the most research behind it. MTRR has to do with methylation of B12. So this indicates that giving her pre-methylated B12, you know, sublingual form may be helpful with the fatigue.
And then overall B production and need, she's at 19%. So B12 is definitely a big one to consider for this patient.
So based on these labs, we're getting that a multi-strain probiotic with maybe something like 100 billion twice daily could be a really helpful addition. We gave her a multi-strain probiotic. We'll sometimes use one by Claire, sometimes use Orthobiotic 100. There's a variety of ones that are really good. So we'll, that to get her those Bifidobacterium, those Lactobacillus plantarum can be potentially helpful in her case. Sublingual B12, and then carnitine pending normal thyroid markers.
So, and then of course, other things that we did, you know, on top of those last labs, that last slide is really focused on some of the things we talked about at the end, 23andMe, you know, those type of labs. But, you know, remember, we also find the H. pylori, we also find the SIBO. And what makes her so interesting is, like, as we treat these different microorganisms, the gluten, like Miles said, did give her some significant change. But as we treat the microorganisms, we have actually not really seen much change in her. And she is down all in all. I think we've been working together for certainly a solid year now. And she's dropped about 10 pounds, and she's now pretty stable with those 10 pounds, but they were pretty intense to get off, and her weight would, like, jump up and down, where she would get down 7, but then she'd be up all those 7, and that went on for a long time, so we finally got 10 to come off her and stick.
Diarrhea. She's since lost a little more than that.
Oh, yeah.
So she's down about 17 now.
Right, so there was a new treatment that she's working on that's helped with the last little bit of that weight. And the diarrhea, since going off a celiac or going on the celiac diet, that has certainly calmed down a bunch for her too. But there certainly is a tendency still towards some looseness. So there's still something that's going on likely in her gastrointestinal tract.
And we gave her some liposomal DIM for some of the mold stuff, and that actually seemed to really help her. So DIM was one that helped. And we have seen positive trends in her labs over time. We didn't include them all, but we've seen triglycerides go in a positive direction, LDLs go in a positive direction. We've seen a lot of different markers move in the right direction. So there's been progress from the lab perspective, but not as much progress on her symptom picture as we would really have liked to have seen by now. So we're still trudging along. This is a tough case and we're considering, you know, where to go next. And we're looking at assessing fatty liver more fully and focusing a little more on how to get those triglyceride levels down. We're considering more significant dietary changes. I've talked to her about ketogenic diet and potato diet. She tried the potato diet for weight loss for a couple days now, and last time we saw her, and she lost a couple pounds in those couple days, but it was a little bit hard to do. So we'll see if she is able to or motivated to continue with that. And
tell me a little more about that.
And that's the potato diet is essentially a way to manage weight, and it's basically eating just potatoes. And you can have a little bit of salt on them, no condiments. If you cook and then cool them 24 hours, they're good prebiotics. So that can help to add a little bit of extra food for the bifido in the body, in the gut. So, you know, it's another sort of bonus to that for her. And people tend to do between 2 to 5 or 3 to 5 days in a row of it, and then take some days off. And maybe someone could do 3 days a week, not exercise much at all, much if at all, during the days of doing the potatoes, and taking it kind of easy on those days if possible. And so people do tend to, even people who struggle with weight loss, lose approximately a pound a day on that diet, and they can, one would think that the blood sugar markers would go all haywire as a result of eating all potatoes from an intuitive sort of just common sense perspective, but interestingly, they don't. Interestingly, the blood sugar markers tend to get better for the most part, but of course, good to monitor those. So it's an interesting diet that is not new. It's been happening since the 1800s, but it's gained some momentum and popularity recently. So there's a lot of people writing about their experiences and forums. So there's a lot of online material for people to read about that if they'd like to. And then, of course, ketogenic. It's something she's tried before. She was successful with some weight loss while doing it, but it's hard. She was under the impression that she had to do it forever, which I told her, no, you don't. You could do it for 6 months and then stop, but you do need to commit for at least a few months to get into that state and be able to really be making the metabolism work from ketones and get the good benefits from it. And we like a modified ketotic diet. It's not as intense, that adds coconut oil, lysine, and leucine to allow for a little bit more carbohydrate, more in the between 50 and 100 grams instead of just less than 50 grams, to give a person a chance to eat a little bit of some antioxidants like berries and some things like prebiotics. So that can be helpful.
So, and it's just really important if somebody is doing a ketotic diet that they actually are monitoring that they get into and stay into ketosis. So it's not enough to just say, okay, I'm going to cut out carbs, I'm going to increase my fats, and that should do it. Because what we see from, say, a metabolic perspective, that if we're going for a ketosis and we don't actually get there, that some of that diet can actually do the reverse of what that diet's meant to, that it can actually be bad for the metabolic system in the body. And so it's really important that we are instructing people on ketosis. And the biggest thing is making sure that they are testing themselves regularly throughout the day to make sure that they are learning what their individual body can and cannot eat in order to keep them in a ketotic state.
And the best testing methods are the breath and blood. And those aren't sort of the most common. The most common is the urine test strips, which are a good place, easy place to start, but getting breath and blood monitors are an optimal way to really help a person assess ketosis and stay there.
And then other things that we did, in addition to what's here on this, and that we're considering in addition to what's here on this slide, is one, to go further into the mold. So we started the liposomal den, which helps to open up the pathways of detoxification. But that's really only the beginning of the whole, you know, mold detoxification process. So you know, certainly need to, you know, go further into using things like binders now. Alpha-lipoic acid is a really interesting idea because it really helps to pull toxins, metals, you know, just toxic substances out of our cells and even out of our brain. ALA can cross the blood-brain barrier. So it can be so good to get molds out, to get toxins out, these things that are actually causing a lot of inflammation. So that's definitely a good place to go next.
And we've also been just starting some gut-based hypnosis with her. And there's some fascinating research about gut-based, gut-focused hypnosis for digestive issues and really stubborn IBS and diarrhea and constipation. And so we've just gotten started with that. She's noticed some improvement from that, but still on the loose stool end of things. So she's at this point at, after some of the gut-focused hypnotherapy, she's at essentially a normal stool first thing in the morning. And then as she goes on throughout the day, she may have a couple of loose stools, but she gets that one nice firm stool in the morning. So that's been some good progress, but still something happening that we need to dive deeper into.
And so we're pretty much running out of time for today. So I think we should save case four for the next conference. Do you guys have any questions on anything we talked about today?
The other mind root causes that we really would like to be working on in this case is that we'd really like to have a sense for the capacity for self-care, self-love. And so it's been a difficult, we've opened that dialogue, but it's been challenging to get more of a, you know, get into it deeply. So there's been a bit of resistance there, but that resistance is telling us that there is a lack of self-love that's playing into this case. So that's something that we're definitely also looking at. How can we approach that in a way that'll be better received? And so that's something that is good to assess and address in any case, but definitely in this case is a something that's at play. And there's a lot of, there's body image issues, there's issues with feeling frustrated with trying so hard and not getting the results. And so those sorts of issues are ones that really can make a difference if we're able to help a person to accept and embrace what is as it is, forgive themselves, love themselves fully, even through the struggle, and then keep on working towards getting better at the same time.
Thanks, guys. We'll see you soon. Have a great night.
Thanks so much.